Welcome to the audio summary of The Dark Side of Innovation. The Dark Side of Innovation is an essential guide to surviving and leveraging disruption. This book summary is divided into two parts. You are listening to part one. Introduction. Innovation is usually considered the engine of business success. But did you know that innovation can also have a dark side? The once powerful Kodak toppled despite its massive response to the threat of a new innovation, digital photography. Even with numerous patents, major investments, and a 20-year lead time, Kodak eventually succumbed to the value-destroying innovation that upended the photography industry. In The Dark Side of Innovation, I present stories of successes and failures at dozens of businesses that faced innovations impacting their profitability. I outlined methods for businesses to predict industry change and protect businesses against profit-destroying innovations. Armed with these techniques, companies can be ready for the dark side of innovation. A chance meeting. I'd like you to imagine this hypothetical scenario. You are representing your company at a conference in a country which has just opened up for business. Since this country was closed to the rest of the world, there's not much known about it, except that it is going to be a big business market. And therefore, everybody is trying to beat everyone else for the gold rush. When you are checking into the hotel, you bump into your friend whom you have not met for a few months. You realize that both of you are at the same conference and you have that evening free. So you decided to meet up for dinner. A few hours after you check into the hotel, you meet up for dinner at a restaurant close by, which was suggested by the concierge itself. While you are in the middle of your meal, the waiter comes to you and leans over and says, "Sir, you have been chosen to get a free dinner this evening." You are obviously very happy, and you look at him, surprised, asking, "What makes me get this free dinner?" And he explains to you that this is a tradition of their country in which every year, one person is chosen to play this national game with a guy called Zolo. He explains that when you are done with your dinner, you will meet this guy called Zolo outside the restaurant. He will have a gun and a sword and a choice for you to make. If you choose the gun, he will make you play Russian roulette with him. And if you choose the sword, you will end up losing one of your arms. You are obviously shocked. You don't even believe it. This could not be happening. But the waiter explains to you that, "Sir, people have already started gathering outside in anticipation of this national event. Now you are in a bind. If you choose the gun, you have to play Russian roulette with this guy. And the other option is no good either. You hate both of these choices. Now, the question is, what would you do?" "Well, if you are like me, you will try to find a way not to go outside, right?" When I ask this question to any group of people, most people do not want to be in that situation. But if you are forced to make a choice, what choice would you make? Actually, most people are paralyzed when given this choice. So let me give you a much more simpler choice to make. In this new choice, you have two options. Option one, you give me $50 and we are done. Option two, you toss a coin and if you win in the coin toss, you give me nothing. But if you lose the coin toss, you give me $100. Now, what would you choose? When I ask this question in a group, a majority of the group always wants to toss the coin rather than give me $50. The interesting thing is that the same question has been asked to thousands of people and their answer is also very similar. Most people want to toss the coin rather than hand over $50. But what is surprising about this choice is that both the options are the same. You see, the expected value in option one is minus 50 because you are giving me $50. The expected value in option 2 is also minus 50 because the probability weighted average of the two outcomes is minus 50. So here is the problem in this situation. When a large number of people are, in general, given two options which are similar in nature, you would expect approximately half of those people would choose one option and the other half of the people would choose the other option. But in this situation, what was found is that people over and over choose one option over the other. Now, why would they do that? There's only one explanation why people choose to toss the coin rather than hand over $50. And the answer is that subconsciously, people believe that the probability of winning in that coin toss is greater than 50%. There is no other explanation why so many people would want to choose the coin toss. This research came out of behavioral decision theory work done by Kahneman and Tversky. This research also led to a Nobel Prize. What it showed is that when people are given two choices which are exactly the same, but one is a definite loss and the other one is a probabilistic loss, people systematically underestimate the probability of losing. As a result, people tend to become more risk-prone, or they take more risks without realizing that they are taking that extra risk. When I was doing research on innovation, I realized a strong parallel between this decision-making scenario and what companies face on a regular basis. What I found is that very often companies have to make a choice between a probabilistic loss and a definite loss when they face a certain kind of innovation. Under those situations, managers across companies, across industries, choose to take a more risky path and underestimate the probability of loss or risk involved. And therefore, they end up making bad choices. Let me give you an example. Let me take you through the story of Kodak. Now, Kodak was a household name which was very successful in the photography industry. It had more than 80% of market share and its business was really lucrative. You know, it had gross margins of upwards of 80%. In the early 80s, Sony, the consumer electronics company, launched the first digital camera. A digital camera, as you know, does not need a film, and therefore, it threatened the business of Kodak in a very big way. Kodak obviously took note of this existential threat to its business very early on. As a result, it decided to invest very heavily in digital technology, a technology that Kodak knew nothing about. It invested more than 50% of its R&D budget over a 10-year period to learning and mastering this technology. That amounted to more than $5 billion. Now, because of this aggressive effort behind digital technology, Kodak was able to generate some of the most valuable patents in this space. It had the patent for the heart of the digital camera, the digital sensor. You may know that it is the sensor that allows you to capture the image in a digital camera. That sensor then became the standard for the industry. It similarly had numerous other patents, but beyond the patents, it also created more than 50 digital products in that period of 10 years. And beyond the technology, it also made many organizational changes. The board hired George Fisher from Motorola. Now, Motorola was a hardware company, and the board of Kodak hired Fisher to lead Kodak because it believed that photography was going to be a hardware business going forward. Who else other than George Fisher would be fit to lead Kodak into the new era? So when we step back and look at Kodak's case, what do we see? we see that Kodak faced an existential threat from the digital camera. The new technology could have replaced the film roll. Furthermore, almost all of profits for Kodak came from the film roll. And what digital technology did was to threaten this source of profit for Kodak. In response, Kodak made extensive efforts to deal with this threat. So what was the result? Well, the result was that Kodak still went into bankruptcy by 2012. It faced a secular decline in the market. Its market share went from 80% in film to 18% in digital era, and Kodak wasn't able to make much money in the new world. And as a result, it was not able to survive and had to exit the business. Now you may be wondering, why did that happen? The reason is very interesting. It had to do with the choice that Kodak faced. And that choice was the same choice that you faced in that hypothetical situation in that restaurant when you were going to meet Zolo. It is also the same choice that I gave you when I asked you to choose between giving me $50 or tossing the coin. Kodak's choice was to either embrace this new technology or to avoid it. If Kodak embraced the digital technology, its overall profits would certainly decline because the digital cameras had a much lower margin than the film roll business had. But it would have likely survived if it had embraced that technology. It would have been the equivalent of choosing the sword. The other option was to avoid the technology. Who knew if digital technology would really succeed? In fact, what if Kodak tried to actively underemphasize the technology? Then it may maintain its massive profits. The only downside was that if Kodak avoided the technology, but that technology succeeded in the market, then what? In that case, Kodak would obviously die. This was the option similar to choosing the gun and playing Russian roulette with Zolo. What did Kodak do? Well, it decided to toss the coin, and it chose to play Russian roulette. Managers within Kodak realized, as they were close to launching these products, that digital cameras were much lower margin business than the film roll business. For example, one of the managers at Kodak said, "We are moving into an information-based company, but it is very hard to find anything with profit margins like color photography that is even legal." In fact, the middle managers in Kodak believed that digital was the absolutely wrong thing to do. They believed that maybe this technology will never do well, and therefore they began preventing the firm from moving fully and aggressively into the digital era. When it came to commercialization efforts, Kodak's managers did not do as good a job as they could have done. The key thing to remember is that it was not George Fisher or one single person who made Kodak choose the gun over the sword. It was a collective emergent decision of the firm. As a result, Kodak ended up bankrupt. Another company in the same industry, Polaroid, was also in the same situation. Now, Polaroid had a 10% of the market all to itself. Polaroid controlled the instant photography industry segment, and that again was a very lucrative market. Polaroid had the same response as Kodak had. It invested heavily in digital technology when the digital cameras emerged. But closer to commercialization stage, Polaroid's managers were asking, "Why are we doing this?" One of them said, "Why should we go into a 38% margin business when I can get 70% in film? Why do I want to do this?" And as a result of a series of similar decisions at various places in Polaroid, Polaroid went from 10% of the market to 0% of the market. It filed for bankruptcy in 2001. Now you see, when you look at both these cases of Polaroid and Kodak, both these companies behaved exactly the same way. The company had to make a choice between two options. The first option was to embrace digital technology, which would lead to a definite reduction in profits and revenues. The second option was to avoid the technology and maybe prevent the firm from moving there. If the technology didn't succeed, they would continue to thrive. In both situations, these companies hesitated in embracing the innovation. Now, what was so strange about these innovations and the choices related to them? The issue was that in both cases, the choices were in a loss domain, which means that both the options had a negative expected value. If they embraced the innovation, the expected value was negative. And if they ignored it, the expected value was again negative. From the research by Kahneman and Tversky, we know that in a loss domain, when two choices have negative expected value, decision makers make major mistakes. They become risk-seeking. You know that in general, innovations are not of this kind. You know, they don't have a negative expected value in general. In general, innovations lead to higher profits and higher revenues. Why else would someone innovate if not for profits and revenue growth? Of course, there is a certain amount of risk involved in every innovation, but the promise of that innovation is higher profit and higher revenues. In the book, I share dozens of examples of innovations that instead of increasing the profits and revenues, they threaten to destroy the profits of an incumbent. I call these innovations profit-destroying innovations. What I found for Kodak and Polaroid was also true in a large number of other companies across many industries. When firms faced profit-destroying innovations, they tend to hesitate in making a choice. They appear to choose Russian roulette, and as a result, often end up getting disrupted. In my book, I go through dozens of examples of profit-destroying innovations and how they stymied various companies, various managers, and led them to take suboptimal decisions. The story of Swiss watch industry. The second example that I go through in my book is that of the Swiss watch industry. For hundreds of years, Swiss watchmakers used to be the dominant players in the world. All the watches, for a longest time period, used to be mechanical watches. These watches used to contain more than 100 small, in fact, minute components that needed to be physically made by hand. And if these components were not made perfectly, the watches would not keep good time. And since watches used to be the timekeeping devices, a good watch was something that would keep good time. The Swiss had an apprenticeship system for maybe a few hundred years. And as a part of that system, an apprentice watchmaker would learn from the master. And the knowledge was passed from one generation of artisans to the next, year after year, over and over again. And this system allowed the Swiss watchmakers to remain the best watchmakers in the world. In the early 1970s, a new technology emerged, the quartz technology. Now, quartz is a crystal which has its own natural frequency. And if you can tap into that frequency, you can keep time in a watch without having to go through this process of making over 100 minute components. When the quartz technology came on the scene, almost anybody could create a watch that could keep perfect time. As a result, the foreign competitors began to adopt quartz technology. It allowed them to create watches that they could sell as a perfect timekeeper. So foreign watchmakers like the Americans and the Japanese began to make these quartz watches very easily using this off-the-shelf technology and started to flood the market with their watches. Obviously, these were cheap plastic watches. When the Swiss looked at them, they said, "Why should we compete with Japan and Hong Kong? They make junk and give it away. We have no margins there." And you know what the result was? Within the next 10 years, the Swiss exports of watches almost disappeared. Swiss exports fell from 40 million watches in 1973 to 3 million watches in 1983. Initially, the Swiss ceded ground at the low end of the market, and the competitors grabbed that space. Unfortunately, the competition didn't stop at the low end. It continued to improve its watches and encroached on the middle segment. The Swiss gave that away too. And then they even started knocking on the higher end of the market. And the Swiss watchmakers continued to cede ground, saying, "You know, we don't have any margins. We don't want to play there." Early on, the Swiss watchmakers faced the same choice. Embrace a profit-destroying innovation, quartz, or ignore it. They decided to ignore it, and they ended up losing their world dominance in watchmaking. Over a period of 10 years, from 1973 to 83, over 50% of firms in Switzerland in the watchmaking industry went out of business. More than 50% of the people employed in this industry lost their jobs. This case study again shows the same story. A company, and in this case, hundreds and thousands of companies facing a profit-destroying innovation, underestimated the likelihood of the success of that particular innovation. As a result, it chose a path which led to its own disruption. And this happened not for one company, but for so many of them. The case of mutual fund industry. I found the same story play out in the mutual fund industry too. And that is the third industry that I explore in great depth in the book, The Dark Side of Innovation. If you own a mutual fund, you know that there are two kinds of mutual funds: an active fund and a passive fund. But before 1975, all mutual funds used to be actively managed funds. In an actively managed fund, a fund manager makes security selection based on research, based on market timing, and hopes to pick the securities at the right time, and therefore hopes to make more money than everybody else in the market. Such a firm has an army of research staff who extensively scans the market and looks for securities to get in and get out of. However, John Bogle, who is well known for his stint as the CEO of Vanguard, found something very surprising in his research. He found that when you look at the entire market, all the fund managers put together as a community underperformed the index. His logic was very simple. See, all the investors in the market make the market. So the average return for that group of investors would be the market return. But the fund houses spend a lot of time and resources and effort on research and trading of securities. And as a result, they end up paying some cost for this effort. So when you reduce that cost, on an average, all these actively managed funds make less money than the average of the market. So he came up with a value proposition for investors which was different and much better than what existed in the market at that time. He suggested the idea of an index fund. An index fund basically makes you buy all the securities in an index like an S&P 500 and hold on to them. The fund does not trade the security. When you do that, you actually get the index returns. But since you're not doing any trading or research, you're not spending money on all those activities that an actively managed fund spends on. And as a result, you pay much less cost. And so on an average, an index fund would make higher return than the average of all actively managed funds. That was a brilliant thinking. So the counterintuitive result of this is that if you just buy an index fund and hold it, you will do as well as the market with very little cost. And you would do better than an average active fund investor would. The benefits for the investor lay in paying much lower cost than what you would pay for an active fund. Bogle promised a 86% reduction in costs than an average active fund. Now that is a very interesting concept, right? You create an index fund which costs 1/6 the cost of an active fund, and you do better than an average actively managed funds. It's a great solution. It's also a no-brainer. But here is the problem. For the fund management industry, index funds are a profit-destroying innovation. Mutual funds make money by charging investors for management fee. When the index fund charges 86% lower fee, it also lowers the revenue by 86%. So if the entire industry embraced index fund, the industry would see a revenue reduction of 86%. With that level of revenue reduction, your overall profit pool would also shrink. That's why it is a profit-destroying innovation. Now you may be wondering, what was the reaction of other fund houses for the index fund concept? Early on, the largest fund houses said that nobody will want to buy this product. People don't want an average performance. They want above average performance. They even belittled Bogle, saying that he is unpatriotic because the core of America is exceptionalism. But what was Bogle peddling? He was peddling mediocrity. So that was one of the criticisms leveled against him. But as a result of this, none of the main fund houses entered into the index fund industry. Vanguard had almost an uncontested path for the next 20 years. During this time, as Bogle educated more and more investors, Vanguard went from an unknown tiny company to becoming the largest asset manager in the world. And what was the reason? When faced with a profit-destroying innovation, most mutual fund companies decided to ignore rather than embrace the innovation. They underestimated the probability of success of index funds, and that is why Vanguard succeeded. Obviously, if everybody else had embraced index funds right away, Vanguard would not have had a chance at becoming big. Synthesis of three industry cases. So by now, you have seen that there are three industries that I talked about in which hundreds of companies behaved in the same way. They all had a choice between a gun and the sword, and they all chose to play Russian roulette. All of them avoided the profit-destroying innovation, and that led to their demise. And this is the constant pattern I discuss in my book. I found that when incumbents face a profit-destroying innovation, they behave as deer in the headlights. They are not decisive and they lose time in hesitation. It is as if the truth is hidden from their view. It is in the blind spot of the decision maker. It is on the dark side. And that is why I call the book The Dark Side of Innovation. But there is one more reason why I call it The Dark Side of Innovation. You see, the outcome of such innovations often included large-scale disruption and dislocation. They threaten to destroy profits rather than promise growth and profits. And that's the second reason why I called these profit-destroying innovations the dark side of innovation. Now, this brings us to the end of part one of this audio summary of the book, The Dark Side of Innovation. In the second part of this audio summary, I will share the antidote to the dark side of innovation. I will share a methodology to deal with it. I developed the methodology in the book after learning from the successes and failures of companies that faced the dark side of innovation. This concludes part 1 of the audio summary of Dark Side of Innovation.